Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the People Speak Radio Show here on BBS Radio. This is, again, your host, Charles Giuliani. Very important guest joining us this evening, Allison Weir. She's a journalist. She's also president of the Council for the National Interest, as well as executive director of If Americans Knew. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing Americans with information on topics of importance that are misreported or underreported in the American media. So as you might guess, this is a very important service that she's providing here, because there is, unfortunately, all too much underreporting or misreporting in our media today. So again, she's serving a very important function. Glad to have you, Allison.
Hi, I'm glad to be on your show. Thank you.
Yeah, tell us a little bit first about the council for the... And by the way, was that a good introduction? I know there's some other things that you've been involved in. Did you want to add anything more to that? You got quite a resume here.
Well, that's the main one. I started that organization, If Americans Knew, about 10 years ago, after I had been one of the Americans who did not know what was going on in Israel-Palestine. And so when I, through sort of a strange set of circumstances, began to learn it, I then started that.
Excellent. And is that what you focus primarily on, the Palestinian, Israeli-Palestinian issue, or do you focus on domestic issues as well?
Well, to a degree. Mainly we focus, our main focus is on Israel-Palestine. But since the Israel lobby is so significant in the United States, in Congress and in the media and at the White House, really at every level of our country, that means that we do focus sometimes on domestic issues, in the sense that, you know, wherever they touch on
Israel
or Palestine.
Right. Before we continue, I just want to mention your website. Is it ifamericansknew.org?
Yes, it is.
Ifamericansknew.org is the website, folks. You can go and check that out. I'm just curious, if you don't mind me asking, are you of Jewish descent? It sounds like a Jewish name, if I'm not mistaken.
It sort of sounds like it, but it's not. It's because it sounds sort of like a German name, if, you know, a lot of times.
Or German Jew or something, yeah.
Can be,
yeah.
Jewish, exactly. But Weir is actually a Scottish name.
Oh, is it really? I wouldn't have guessed.
It's actually my former husband's name, but I had it for a long time, so I still have it.
The reason I ask, I'm
just
curious.
But it's actually, my background, it is, you know, it's one of these awkward things, because most of us don't really pay attention to whether somebody's Methodist or Jewish or Catholic. We like to sort of think we treat each other the same and we're all,
related,
we're all Americans.
The only reason I ask that is because I've interviewed quite a few people who are Jewish who have been fighting against things like this, you know, the Israeli lobby. And I think that's
right.
Great when you have that, because you can't be labeled, you know, an anti-Semite or, you know, the typical stereotype stuff.
Yeah.
So I was just curious if that was the case. But
people thought that I might be Jewish, because it does sound like a name that could be. And a lot of times the people that are aware of this issue and work on it often are Jewish. So at first I was attacked by the pro-Israel group being called allegedly self-hating, because they thought I was Jewish.
Even
and then
they
when they discovered I was not, then I suddenly, then they began to call me anti-Semitic, you know, which is also not true, but that's
they got
the way it works.
The little Trump cards, Now, you probably have some Jewish people working for you or with you, right?
Well, with us, yes. We're a very small organization, so we're just sort of tiny, so we don't have anybody that's Jewish working for us right now, but certainly a lot of my close colleagues and people that I feel that I work with and learn from and share information with are Jewish Americans and Arab Americans and Muslim Americans and sort of everything else.
Well, you're a small group now. Let's hope that changes in the near future. So obviously that's the aim of If Americans Knew. How does that relate to the work of the Council of the National Interest? Is it pretty much the same type
agenda? it's sort of interesting. They're complementary. What happened is, maybe, should I give a little bit of my background, how I got involved in this?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, what happened is, my background is journalism. Back about 13 years ago, I was the editor of a small newspaper in Sausalito, California, a very small one, just a weekly community newspaper. But that fall of 2000 is when the second Palestinian uprising began, and was in the news for a while, where you would see those images of, you know, Israeli tanks going into the West Bank and children throwing stones against them. And I decided to pay attention and try to just follow the news on Israel-Palestine and understand it and, you know, be up on the latest news. And when I did that, I had never done that. I'd never paid really attention to this issue before. I raised three children and, you know, was more of a local journalist. So when I finally paid attention to it, as a journalist, I very quickly noticed that I was getting very one-sided coverage, that from, you know, the NPR, the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, pretty much everywhere that you would hear from and about Israelis a great deal, as we should. But then I wanted the whole story, and I expected that I would hear from and about Palestinians, since it's a conflict between the two populations.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I noticed it came much less frequently, and sort of near the end of the story, and, I just wasn't getting the full picture. So I began to go on the Internet a bit to try to learn, well, you know, what is the full picture? And because we have the Internet now, and there are very good media both in the Palestinian territories and in Israel itself that would tell much more about what was going on, it was pretty shocking to see what was actually going on compared to what we were getting. After a while, I began to look into it more and more, got increasingly curious and drawn into it, and it began to seem really like maybe the biggest cover-up I had ever seen. And we've all seen a lot of them. But this seemed bigger because it was across the political spectrum, and it had been going on clearly a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed so important that I finally decided to quit my job in Sausalito and travel over to the West Bank and Gaza
and see for yourself.
That's right, to see for myself what was going on. And that was in February and March of 2001.
2001, you said?
Yes.
Yeah, just 12 years ago. Wow.
Yeah.
It's pretty shocking, isn't it? It's a whole different picture than what we have portrayed for us in our media.
That's right, a very, very different picture.
Most Americans have this delusionary view that our government is constantly working to stop, you know, ethnic cleansing in the world and other human rights abuses, and yet they're turning a complete blind eye to one of the most horrific, if not the most horrific, blatant examples of it.
It's just such a long-standing one, too. And it is. It's just appalling what was going on. And that it was, it is such a cover-up. So many people that don't know, so many people that are, I feel that, you know, many Americans on both sides of the political spectrum are decent people and want a government of that protects us and is also, you know, taking the right stand on things. That's what we think our country stands for. That's what
and honest with us,
for.
Straightforward with us, yeah.
That's right. And we just weren't, you know, the policies, I discovered the policies that we're taking in the Middle East, both parties, are pretty much just run by this very powerful lobby.
Mm-hmm.
A special interest lobby, just like there are lots of special interest lobbies in Washington, D.C. that run things. But most of them have a fairly strong counter lobby, so there's a bit of balance over time. But in this case, there was very little counter lobby, and this is such a powerful lobby that people are afraid to even talk about it, as we just saw with Chuck Hagel. You can't, you know, anybody can talk about the oil lobby or the pharmaceutical lobby or the gun lobby or, any of these others you can talk about, either defend or criticize, but there can be a debate. You're not even supposed to say the word, the Israel lobby, the phrase.
Right.
You know, it's bizarre, especially since it's one of the most powerful lobbies in our country.
If not the most, yeah.
I personally think it's the most powerful.
Yeah. And it influences our politicians on behalf of a foreign government, not in our interest at all.
That's right. You know, this is a very different, you know, as I said just now, well, we have, you know, this is how things are. But as you say, this is considerably different in one way, and that is that this is for a foreign country. Normally, that kind of lobby is required to register as a foreign agent. You can do that. You can lobby on behalf of Cuba or Ireland or France or somewhere, but you register as a lobbyist from a foreign country.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are special things attached to that, special oversight. You know, people know who you are, what you're representing. In this case, because it's so powerful and has been so powerful for so many decades, that even though the Justice Department several times has tried to go after it and require it to obey our law, it's able to elude it. So we have a lobby on behalf of Israel, with many, many institutions within it, but they don't, especially the main one on Capitol Hill, APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, does not register as a foreign lobby, even though it's lobbying on behalf of a foreign country.
It's astonishing.
And that's just a measure of what's going on here.
And like you said,
so anyway,
when I
started the organization, If Americans Knew, to just try to get these facts to people, you know, without any kind of ideological or political spin in either conservative or liberal direction. Just, you know, I think that our citizens deserve the facts. We give Israel over $8 million per day, more than to any other country, and therefore, it's very important that we know what's being done with our money, how it's being used, and how it's damaging us, as well as just creating enormous tragedy and violence in the region itself.
And like you said, if Americans only knew, they're completely oblivious to not only how powerful they are, but the degree to which they're influencing our government and, of course, our media. There's a very powerfully concentrated control in our media by, you know, this lobby group, AIPAC, and its subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, you know, some people, I'm sure some of your listeners have been aware of this, you know, long before I was. So some people caught on to it and probably didn't have the time to look into it as thoroughly and probably didn't have the time to travel over there and really see for themselves what's going on. But a certain number of people sort of know this is going on. I think most don't know how bad it is. But most people don't. Most surveys show that, you know, that most people don't. It's sort of interesting, though, because a typical survey, and this is a, you know, over 100 Gallup polls, will show that people really don't want to take sides on Israel-Palestine, even though our government is so enormously taking the Israel side and giving massive amounts of money to Israel, all sorts of special perks that no one else gets, even some Americans don't get.
Weapons.
You know, sometimes preferring them over American companies that costs thousands of jobs for Americans here.
Yeah.
So even though Israel, our government run basically at the policy level by this lobby group, favors Israel enormously more than any other country on earth. The American public doesn't want that. We want sort of fair policies. The surveys show that people want to stay out of things unless we really are truly have a reason to be part of them. Maybe if there's famine and enormous need or something, then people do want to help out. But normally they sort of think, let's take care of things at home. So about two-thirds to three-quarters will say we should not take sides on Israel-Palestine. I think it's showing a sort of common sense that they realize they don't know exactly what's going on there, and therefore we should stay out of it. Once, of course, you really learn what's going on there, you realize that the Palestinians are the weak party, and we just continually give massive amounts of money and weaponry to a country that's based on what is truthfully ethnic cleansing. Even though that sounds like a strong phrase, that's the terminology that is now used for this kind of movement and historical situation where a population decides to get rid of other people they don't want. In this case, it's people called Zionists, a political ideology, that wanted to create a Jewish-only state on land that already had Christians and Muslims living there. And so the leaders of this movement decided, well, you know, that doesn't matter, we'll just push them out. And eventually they did that. They bought up some of the land with the intention of getting rid of the people that way. But only a little bit. They, you know, even after decades of trying, they only owned about 6 or 7% of the land. So then there was a massive war, and through violence they managed to kick out most of the people. And that's how Israel was created.
It truly is amazing what they can get away with. You know, other nations, no other nation, in fact, would ever dare to pull any of the stunts Israel has pulled. But Israel has pulled many. You know, I'm sure you must know about their nonconformity to international nuclear ban agreements. You know, over the decades, they've gotten away with it. The United States and indeed the entire world community has turned a blind eye to this. They have so many nuclear weapons amassed now, nobody actually even knows what they've got. They have lied consistently since the 1960s, denying that they even had a nuclear program. I mean, it's just amazing what they get away with.
It is. It's truly just astonishing. Because it's sort of, you know, as you say, the nuclear program is especially interesting. Because on the one hand, they officially never acknowledge that they have nuclear weapons.
Right.
No American president that I'm aware of has ever acknowledged that they have these nuclear weapons. In fact, in government, I don't know if anybody has. So
well,
everybody's supposed to.
I'll tell you in a minute there was one significant exception to that, but go ahead.
And, you know, so supposedly they don't have them, but implicitly they threaten the region with the fact that they do have them and almost deployed them in 1973. So there's sort of this nuclear blackmail going on by Israel, while the American public, you know, unless you really delve into it the way you and I have, the average person doesn't even know Israel has nuclear weapons and has had them a long time.
Clueless.
So even though there's all this discussion about Iran possibly developing nuclear weapons, there's no evidence that anybody has found that they're doing that. There's every reason why they would. If you have a neighbor that invades it's the countries around it and has nuclear weapons, certainly you would want a deterrent.
Actually, I think Iran does have them. In fact, according to Donald Rumsfeld, they're somewhere north, south, east, or west of Tehran. You remember the story about Saddam. We know where his weapons of mass destruction are. They're somewhere north, south, east, or west of Tikrit. Oh, give me a break. So, you know, if he was still the Secretary of Defense today, that's probably what he would say. Well, we know Iran has nuclear weapons.
That's
somewhere
right.
In North South.
Well, you know, you might remember, you know, the way they got us into Iraq, which was largely being pushed by these neocons who had this agenda for a long time to have the U.S. take out Israel's enemies.
Sure.
And the two enemies that were discussed the most, well, actually there were three. Iraq, Iran, and Syria were the three. Yeah. You know, enemies of, you know, potential enemies of Israel.
The
they had already
Axis.
Taken out Lebanon and Egypt other ways.
Right.
So these three were remaining. And, you know, one of the ways that the American public was convinced to at least allow this invasion to go forward of Iraq, one of the ways was supposedly there were weapons of mass destruction there, which, of course, turned out to be, you know, completely untrue, as many people were saying at the time, but the media were barely reporting the people that were actually knowledgeable on it. And then Judith Miller, who was the very pro-Israel Zionist reporter for the New York Times, who would have front-page stories about these alleged weapons of mass destruction, one of her stories then, as it became clear that there just weren't any, she had another story in which she said, according to, quote, high government sources, they have probably gone to Syria, paving the way for the U.S. to maybe attack Syria. Fortunately, through various circumstances, she lost her influence, and that didn't go anywhere, but, you know, that's what was going on. And now we have the same kind of effort against Iran.
All of these pushes to get us involved in Iran and, of course, Iraq itself, Syria, it all comes from Israel. The Jerusalem Post and Haaretz both admitted, you know, the top two papers in Israel, admitted that the whole reason we went into Iraq was due more to pressure from Israel and its lobby group than anything else.
Yeah, it's and you know, this is on at some levels, lots of people know this. It's very obvious. There's an excellent book on it by David Snagoski, who has really meticulously researched all the evidence for that. Mm-hmm. And yet there's a great effort to cover that up.
Sure.
Surprisingly, in some ways it's surprising, that some of the people that are doing that, because this is the Israel law, you know, the Israel line is to deny that Israel had anything to do with the Iraq war, especially now that people see what a tragic quagmire that is. That, you know, there are all these American soldiers who have been badly injured and killed and, you know, certainly damaged in many ways, coming back from, you know, it's very, very sad to think that there are families that might listen to this, but it's very sad that their sons and husbands and brothers were there, you know, fighting for something that they thought was a good reason to fight, but was really the fight on behalf of Israel.
Right. Whose interests are...
And, of course, all these, you know, massive numbers of Iraqis who died or were killed or mutilated or, you know, it's just tragedy on both sides.
Right.
And the very sad fact is not exact, you know, it's not fun to tell all these just enormously tragic things, but the reality is this was pushed by people because they thought it was good for Israel. Now, not all Israelis did at all, of course, not all portions of the Israeli government necessarily thought that, but that's what these individuals with a great deal of power in the administration pushed for, was this invasion of Iraq.
Sure.
And
the neocons.
That's right. And yet within the movement for Palestinian justice, that's a very diverse movement, there are some elements that are trying to cover that aspect up. They're sort of doing, in some ways, some of them intentionally, some of them completely unintentionally, are sort of putting forward Israel's own argument.
But yet, amazingly, if you go back to their own documents, you know, the PNAC group, Project for the New American Century, the neocon think tank group, you know, their September 2000 report, Rebuilding America's Defenses, they didn't blush at all. They came right out and said that their intention was to have the U.S. invade Iraq in the coming years and seize its oil reserves. They even went so far as to say that we need to have a new Pearl Harbor type event to catalyze the American public behind them in support of this agenda.
Yeah, but there's so much, you know, in today's world, this isn't archaeology, of course, we're just talking about very, very recent history. The documents are there. You know, anybody that wants to learn these facts, as I did and other people have, the information's there. It's just that most people are too busy to look into it or think they're doing their homework because they do read the newspaper maybe or listen to the news, and maybe they even go to a few different sources in the mainstream media and are, you know, sort of good citizens in terms of trying to be informed. And yet they're not getting this kind of information, even though it's there to be had. I mean, now and then it's in the mainstream media. So there sometimes will be actually very good articles on some of these aspects in there, but very rarely, and usually with a bit of spin and often buried.
Sure.
And yet the smoking guns are there. It's easy to find this information out. And
you know,
what's been astounding to me is I've been working on this, what was going to be an article, but it's gotten so long that now it's turning into a very short book, about how long this has been going on in this country. And it's been going on, believe it or not, for 100 years. Zionism began, political Zionism, began in the late 1800s. The first Zionist conference was in Basel in about 1896 or 97. So, you know, so a lot of people know that. That's when Theodor Herzl, who was the founder of political Zionism, which was the precursor, what ended up creating the Israeli state, began around the turn of the century. And so it's not surprising, but not many people have looked into it. That means that the Zionist activity in the United States of course, began at that same time period, intensely. You know, there were 20,000 Zionists by about 1905 or 1910. They were very influential in terms of some of the large eastern cities at a time, and yet here we are, you know, a century later, and most of us have, really, I don't know if I'd ever even heard the word Zionist or Zionism. I'm sure I would have had no idea of how to define those.
Right.
You know, I probably would have known it had something to do with the Holy Land or Mount
the Bible
Zion.
Or, yeah, right.
That's right. You know, I really would not have known. And I think I'm typical. I think the average person, if you went to somebody on the street and say, you know, what is Zionism? What is a Zionist? I think very few people could answer that.
Clueless.
And yet,
yeah,
it's been active in this country for 100 years and
sure,
driving our policies.
Very powerfully so,
yeah,
right?
Since about,
I'll tell you what, Allison, we got to actually cut to a short break here, but
sure.
Very important information, folks. Stick with us. We'll get deeper into the discussion when we get back, and I got some questions, too, that are coming in that we'll be giving for our guest here. So stick with us. Be right back.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests from various realms of interest share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson for Normal. And like millions of other responsible Americans, I smoke pot. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana. And it's none of the government's business. Let's get the government out of our private lives once and for all and stop arresting smokers. Let's take a stand for personal freedom. To learn how you can help, go to normal.org.
Come, you masters of war.
Hello, this is Cindy Sheehan. America's war on terror has become a war of terror, with endless drone bombings, continuing military occupation, as well as detention, rendition, and torture still being practiced under the current administration. I lost my precious son Casey to war, and now work towards a day when not one more mother, son, or daughter will suffer such a loss. Listen to my podcast, read my blog, and come join me at any activities I attend near you. Please visit CindySheehanSoapbox.com for more information, and let's work for peace together.
Stellar Flutes is a family-owned and operated business dedicated to producing beautiful, finely handcrafted Native American-style flutes in a variety of sustainable woods. Stellar Flutes are used by both beginner and professional musicians with glowing praise. Easy to play and invoking a calm, meditative feeling, they make a perfect gift for you or someone special. For more information, including videos on selecting and playing the flute, please visit stellarflutes.com or call toll-free 1-888-427-8850.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. Once again, our guest this evening is Allison Weir. She's the president of the Council for National Interest, as well as executive director of If Americans Knew, and her website is ifamericansknew.org. We're talking primarily about the inordinate influence of the Israeli lobby upon our foreign policy and even our domestic policies, control of our media, you know, lying to us just simply through omission. Keeping out of the airwaves certain key facts that would otherwise make Americans aware of what our government is doing in our name, or in some cases not doing, you know, not interfering in areas where it should, interfering in areas where it shouldn't, in the interests of this foreign country called Israel, which very often involves things that are antithetical to our interests, not only outside our interests, but antithetical to them. So there needs to be a grand awareness, as her website implies, if Americans knew. There needs to be an awareness of what's being done in our name and with our tax dollars. You know, if not, we're going to find ourselves in a, we're already in a big mess, but it's going to get a lot worse if something isn't done. Wouldn't you agree, Allison?
I would agree, you know, and many people would, many people in D.C. and elsewhere that are very knowledgeable about this and concerned about what's going on are very, very worried, because this is extremely damaging to the United States. You know, I think many of us, certainly in my case, I started out because I had learned what was going on in the region, in the Palestinian territories and what had been done against Lebanon and other places. That's just so tragic. And I'd seen it firsthand. But then, the more you look into it, what I've become increasingly aware of is the extreme damage it's done to the United States and is doing. You know, it's hurting us enormously financially. It's hurting our prestige in the world. People that used to truly respect us and our system, now we have such a double standard by supporting Israeli actions that are, as you said, the opposite of what the principles that most of us believe that our country stands for and should stand for, and yet we're supporting a country based on an identity that's very different. So it's hurting us that way. Israel itself is spying on the U.S. a great deal. Mm-hmm. They've stolen quite a bit of our technology and then used it to create companies that then compete with American companies and take jobs away. Some of the technology they passed on to the Soviet Union and to China.
And China, yeah.
Again, another way.
Oh, yeah.
So it's astounding. And in the meantime, because of the actions that are going on in recent years, and because people are being led to believe that the danger out there is from Arab terrorists or Muslim terrorists, et cetera, and that there's supposedly this sort of mystical danger, you know, that doesn't, it's, you know, suggest that it's not based on anything real. It's not based on our policies. Just for some reason, we're at risk.
Right.
So then our politicians pass these laws that violate some of our basic principles and the Constitution.
Well, you know, I have a name for these Arab terrorists, Allison, a great many of them. I call them Arabs with Star of David tattoos, because very often these alleged Arabs turn out to be Mossad agents posing as Arabs.
Well, I don't know, you know, the degree. I know that has gone on, certainly historically, especially back at the, in 1947 and 1948.
Oh, sure. King David Hotel bombing.
And 49, and they were trying to, part of Zionism, this, you know, very fervent ideology, was the belief not only that there should be a Jewish state, basically, you know, somewhere in the world, and they settled on Palestine, even though it was already inhabited. So it was not only to create a Jewish state, but it was that there should be an ingathering. They needed all the Jews in the world to go there. And they thought, some of the leaders, and Herzl himself, thought that everybody, you know, every Jewish American, you know, a Jewish Englisher or from France, you know, they thought everybody would just flow in there. And most people didn't want to go there. You know, the majority said, I'm an American, I'm an Englishman, and, you know, whatever, and didn't really choose to go to Palestine.
Yeah.
And so they needed to convince people to go to Palestine so they could create this Jewish state that they wanted and they thought everybody else wanted, but everybody else didn't want. So then they would use various tactics, and one of them was in the Middle East, in places like Iran, Iraq. The Mossad, which is the sort of the Israeli secret
CIA,
CIA type of thing, right, would bomb synagogues so that it looked as though it was the Muslim Brotherhood or some sort of Muslim or extremist against Jews, when in reality those were, in some cases, definitely being done by Zionists on behalf of creating Israel, so that then the Jewish population of Iraq would go to Israel.
Yeah.
This was documented in several cases. It went on in some other countries too. So there have been these false flag types of activities.
One particular group was called Irgun. It was run by, amongst others, Menachem Begin. It was a terrorist group.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. You know, an outright terrorist killed innocent people, were proud of it, bragged about a major massacre at Deir Yassin where they killed about 250 men, women, and children in a little village that actually had been a neutral village in the war, but it was on a section that they wanted to take, so they massacred them, bragged about it afterwards, and this man became a prime minister of Israel, you know, a few decades later.
Sure. He was once asked, Menachem Begin, are you behind the terrorism in the Middle East? And his response was, I am behind all the terrorism in all the world. Very interesting.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's astonishing. Yeah, I wanted to come back to a point earlier. You mentioned about, I think you said something to the effect you weren't sure that any of our presidents even knew about Israel's nuclear program. One exception to that
actually
was...
Actually, not knew. Actually, what I meant to say, maybe I said that, but what I meant to say is that I don't know any of them that said it, you know, have said it publicly.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, okay. I guess that's what it was. Actually, there was one. JFK, actually, was not only speaking out about it, he was demanding accountability from them. He wasn't buying their claim that they didn't have a program. He says, it's not a question of whether you do or not. We know you do. We want to know exactly how far you've gone with it, and we want it to stop. Anyway, as a result of this, David Ben-Gurion actually resigned because of the scandal. You know, he was caught with his pants down, so to speak. And so, you know, he stepped down, and of course, shortly after that, JFK was removed from the scene. And so, you know, he wasn't alive to ensure that there was accountability. And they kept going on with their program, and nobody questioned it after that.
Well, certainly when Johnson came in, he was very friendly to Israel.
Sure.
Much more so than JFK.
U.S. aid massively increased to Israel under his presidency, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, this is, you know, we keep hearing about there's a, quote, a special relationship, and people will sort of say it's our special ally. But there's actually no official alliance with Israel. And they, if there were, they would have responsibilities towards us, which they don't. They, you know, it's sort of all one-sided. We give them money, we give them a lot of technology, we cover for them when they commit a massacre and the world is horrified and the Security Council tries to pass something, we veto it.
Yeah.
You know, we get a little bit from them here and there, but really nothing at all significant compared to what we're giving them.
Oh, yeah. Well, how does it benefit us at all? It only benefits them, this relationship. It's not doing anything for us. You know, I don't know if you ever heard of, this is a very interesting book. I just finished reading it recently. It's called The Iranian Triangle. And the subtitle is the Hidden Role of Israel in the Iran-Contra Affair. This book thoroughly documents how Israel actually was the ones that was the nation that was funneling U.S. weapons to Iran and then passing the money on to the U.S. When the Iran-Contra hearings took place, they actually said that the role of Israel was to be suppressed. It wasn't to be brought up in the hearings at all. And yet they played a major key role in this. It's just a classic example of how this works. Mm-hmm. They play key roles in major criminal activity, and they get a free ride every time.
Yeah, it is. It's astounding. Do you remember the author of that book?
I don't, but it came out in 1988. You can still get it on Amazon. It's out of print, but you can get a used copy. They're still on there.
Yeah, most of the good books are out of print.
yeah, that's for sure. A very interesting read.
I haven't read that one. I've certainly read that in some other books, but I haven't read a whole book on it, so I'll have to make sure to get that one.
Yeah,
Iranian. Yeah, but a number of people have written about that. But again, as you say, it's just suppressed. You know, Israel gets sort of whitewashed out of these things, even when, as in this case, even when it plays a major role, we hear about everything else, but that part of it tends to sort of be left out of
right.
the reporting on a number of occasions.
It's truly amazing. I tell you what, we're kind of running short on time here. I have a few questions that have come in via text. Did you want to take some questions?
Sure.
Sure. And by the way, I mentioned in your website, did you have anything else that you wanted to plug, anything you wanted to direct
people's
attention to?
Well, I should mention more about the Council for the National Interest, which is the other organization, and that's been around for about 20 years, started by a former congressman, Paul Finley, a Republican congressman from Illinois, a very intelligent, principled gentleman from central Illinois who's now about 91 or 92 years old, still very active, and has written an excellent memoir that came out about a year ago called Speaking Out. So, and we're going to be having a conference, a summit, a national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship that I think is going to be extremely important with some top speakers. We're still finalizing the date. It's most likely going to be in April, although we may delay it until next fall. But if people go to our website, councilforthenationalinterest.org, there you can find out the specifics and the details of when and where it will be.
Excellent. So again, the two websites, councilforthenationalinterest.org and ifamericansknew.org, the two websites.
Right.
Was that it? Is anything else?
That's it. That's great.
Okay, excellent. So yeah, let's go to, we got time here for a few questions. Let's see. This is kind of a multifaceted question here. I'll give it to you in segments, I guess. This comes from Robin in California, and she asks, is there a difference between George H.W. Bush and Barack Obama when it comes to supporting the conservative ideology of AIPAC? I'm not sure if they meant George W. Bush or George H.W., but anyway, and Benjamin Netanyahu. Is there a difference between Obama and, I guess, Bush Sr.? I'm not sure. When it comes to the support of conservative ideology of AIPAC and Netanyahu?
I think, well, I'll sort of answer it for both Bushes, so because I'm guessing they might have meant George W. Bush.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, too.
And, there, you know, even though we're told, and a lot of people expect, there's this huge difference between the two men, there's not. You know, Obama has continued the same policies,
Business as usual.
Support for Israel, basically, you know, swearing allegiance to Israel like everybody does. So there's really no difference there. Sometimes this rhetoric sounds better, but the actions are no better and on Israel-Palestine and on the Middle East in general.
That's exactly how I would answer that question.
Bush Sr. was a bit better. Bush Sr. actually did try to stop aid to Israel at one point, or actually stop the loan guarantees that are very significant. Because pretty much every president has tried to force Israel to stop building these highly illegal colonies in the West Bank called settlements. They confiscate Palestinian land, both Christian and Muslim land, illegally to steal people's land and then create a new Jewish-only colony on that land. And it's recognized to be illegal under numerous types of international law. And so every president pretty much at some point or another finally tells them to stop.
They have an incredible, unchallenged arrogance, don't they?
Yeah. George Bush Sr. really tried to, he froze the guarantees for a while, so he actually forced them to back down for a brief period. And many of us feel that's why he did not win a second term. The Israel lobby went after him, the media went after him, and he lost the election.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't, it was supposedly the economy that caused him to lose the election. More likely, it's the fact that the Israel lobby did not want him in again.
Right. They really have that much power. And you know, the way you answered it, it's exactly how I would answer it. The policies, there's no difference. As a matter of fact, there's been no difference, really, with any president for decades on end now when it comes to Israel. It's the same thing. Basically, red carpet rolled out for them. But like you said, the only difference between Obama and Bush is the rhetoric. Obama can say more than five words in a row without tripping over his own tongue. But other than that, no difference in the policy.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, this Robin here goes on with a second part to the question. Could you also describe for us Obama's former Middle East foreign policy advisor, Dennis Ross, and the role that he plays in his ties to Israel and the neocons of the Republican Party?
Sure. I'd be glad to. And also, maybe I'll throw in also Rahm Emanuel.
Oh, sure.
In fact, maybe I'll start start with that one, because that's just such an egregious and very strong example of what's going on.
Yeah.
We had Obama's first White House chief of staff, very, very powerful position, was held by a man named Rahm Emanuel.
Dual citizenship.
Who was an Israeli citizen.
Yeah.
In fact, during the, I think it was the first Gulf War, when the U.S. was at war with Iraq, you know, once again, we initiated the war, but, you know, we were at war with Iraq. So here we have somebody that becomes, you know, a high White House official, you know, supposedly a very patriotic person, one would hope, on some sort of level. Did he volunteer and for American forces? No, he went over and volunteered to be with, work with Israel. So Rahm Emanuel is a very questionable person to have in the White House, and yet that's who we had. His father, in fact, was a member of the Irgun, which you had mentioned earlier,
sure.
A terrorist group. You know, really, even the mainstream Zionists didn't like the Irgun. They worked with them to a degree. They, you know, sometimes coordinated some activities with them, but mostly they did not like them because they were just outright terrorists, very, very violent. And Rahm Emanuel's father was a member of that. Now, the other person that was mentioned, Dennis Ross, is very, very pro-Israel. You know, again, he's grown up with that kind of ideology, and he's often been portrayed, he's one of these groups of people that seems that for with both administrations, both Republican and Democratic administrations, will be one of the primary people working on the Middle East, on Iran currently, I believe, on previously on Israel-Palestine. And yet, rather than having what most people want in the world and in this country, a neutral broker, you know, playing a role as a mediator to try to bring a solution and peace to the Middle East and to Israel-Palestine, we have somebody there that's an Israel partisan.
Right.
So, you know, rather than representing the U.S., he is to a degree, but he's representing Israel. And you know, these people just, they're both parties.
Sure.
Often use the same people.
And, you know, that's another whole issue, too, the dual citizenship thing. This has been going on for a long time. Under Bush Jr., of course, we had Michael Chertoff, head of Homeland Security, another very high position, mm-hmm. occupied by someone with, you know, dual citizenship. Some people might say that that's dangerous because he has dual loyalties. But what I find with a lot of these dual Israeli citizens, and I'm sure you do too, Allison, they actually don't have dual loyalties. Their loyalties are with Israel, period.
I feel that, and it's a strong statement. I, you know, don't worry, there will be plenty of blog posts tomorrow attacking both of us if anyone,
oh, sure.
or whenever people hear this. But the indications are that really when, you know, that I feel that many of these individuals, maybe not all of them, but many of them, I do feel they're, when it really comes down to it, their loyalty is greater to Israel than to the United States.
Far too many of them.
But they don't. You know, again, if somebody's honest, you know, we all have different loyalties, and you know, but these are people serving in the U.S. government who are charged with the best interests of the United States, with representing American citizens, not representing a tiny foreign nation.
Right.
And in fact, I would really say that if I would think it would be sensible for a country, and including ours, that at a certain level of government, you require a person to have only American citizenship. You know, at a certain level of government, you would say, okay, you're a dual citizen with Switzerland or someplace. Nothing against Switzerland, nothing against dual citizenship. I wish I had it. I think it'd be very convenient and probably fun. But, okay, you're now serving in the federal government. You need to choose. And be only an American citizen, or you cannot hold this job.
Absolutely.
I think that would be a reasonable approach. I think other countries may well do that. We used to. Until Israel wanted the dual citizenship, we didn't allow that in this country. It used to be when you got to be 18, you had to choose whether you would be an American citizen or, you know, perhaps a British citizen, if that's what your dual citizenship was.
How many Americans would be happy to find out that someone in high position in government had the dual citizenship with Saudi Arabia? They'd be outraged. Well, why do we accept that with Israel, or for that matter, any other country?
I think I think the minimum that we should require, and this is truly the minimum, but this we should require, is it should be divulged.
Right.
You know, we should know if somebody, if Wolfowitz, who, you know, served a long time in the U.S. government, you know, I think there's a high likelihood he's a dual citizen with Israel. He may not be, but I think there's a good chance that he is. And if so, we should know that. And again, people might say, I don't care, that's fine with me. I wouldn't say that, but, you know, other people might. And if the majority of people say that, then, you know, I think we should be a democratic republic and go with the majority. But we should know it. This should not be hidden information. And right now, for a journalist or anybody wanting to find out from a government official, do you have dual citizenship, there's no way we can find that out that I know of. There's no place that that's recorded. There's no accountability on that. If there's an editor that's responsible for coverage of Israel-Palestine and that editor has a dual citizenship with Israel, there's no way for us to learn that.
Right.
And I think at a certain level, things like that, there's an obligation for that to become public knowledge. You know,
I tell you what, we're really
public,
running out of time, unfortunately. I wish we had more time, Allison. But I wanted to ask you one last quick question. This comes from Sarah in Michigan. Sorry, I wasn't able to get to all the questions. But this is really important. She asks, do you see the UN and its recognition of Palestine and the right to now seek international legal action against Israel? Do you see this as a way to achieving justice, or is it just more smoke screens? Window dressing? Do you see any positive results coming from any of this?
I see it a little bit of both. You know, of course, to a degree, it's window dressing, and it's only as significant as the power dimensions make it significant. But it has some significance because it does now allow legal access to international courts, et cetera, and different kinds of international legal recourse that Palestinians did not have recourse to before. So,
at least the issue is being addressed in some form, whereas in the past that's never been the case.
That's right. You know, so it has some significance. I think in the end,
sure.
I personally think it's probably a good thing as long as people don't make too much of it and think this is the answer.
Right. I really got to cut things short. We're actually running over the time we were supposed to.
Okay.
Sorry about that, but we'll have to have you back on. This has been great. I appreciate the information and the work you're doing. I want to encourage you to keep it up, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Take care, Allison. Okay, folks, we're out of time, but join us next week. Our guest is going to be Michael Parenti, author of The Face of Imperialism, very important leader in the Patriot Movement. You don't want to miss that, so we'll catch you next week. Take care.